Which way?
We followed the path, the two others watching Julio and the little girl and the boys somewhere in the rear. The path went along the river to the bridge. We crossed it and the tracks, people coming to the doors to look at us and more boys materializing from somewhere, until when we turned into the main street we had quite a procession. Before the drugstore stood an auto, a big one, but I didn't recognize them until Mrs. Bland said, "Why, Quentin! Quentin Compson!" Then I saw Gerald and Spode in the back seat, sitting on the back of his neck. And Shreve. I didn't know the two girls.
"Quentin Compson," Mrs. Bland said.
"Good afternoon," I said, raising my hat.
"I'm under arrest. I'm sorry I didn't get your note. Did Shreve tell you?"
"Under arrest," Shreve said. "Excuse me," he said. He heaved himself up and climbed over their feet and got out. He had on a pair of my flannel pants, like a glove. I didn't remember forgetting them. I didn't remember how many chins Mrs. Bland had, either. The prettiest girl was with Gerald in front, too. They watched me through veils with a kind of delicate horror.
"Who's under arrest?" Shreve said. "What's this, mister?"
"Gerald," Mrs. Bland said. "Send these people away. You get in this car, Quentin." Gerald got out. Spode hadn't moved.
"What's he done, Cap?" he said. "Robbed a henhouse?"
"I warn you," Ansa said. "Do you know the prisoner?"
"Know him," Shreve said. "Look here."
"Then you can come along to the squire's. You're obstructing justice. Come along." He shook my arm.
"Well, good afternoon," I said. "I'm glad to have seen you all. Sorry I couldn't be with you."
"You, Gerald," Mrs. Bland said.
"Look here, constable," Gerald said.
"I warn you, you're interfering with an officer of the law," Ansa said. "If you've anything to say, you can come to the squire's and make cognizance of the prisoner."
We went on. Quite a procession now, Ansa and I leading. I could hear them telling them what it was, and Spode asking questions, and then Julio said something violently in Italian, and I looked back and saw the little girl standing at the curb, looking at me with her friendly, inscrutable regard.
"Get on home!" Julio shouted at her. "I beat hell out of you!"
We went down the street and turned into a bit of lawn in which, set back from the street, stood a one-story building of brick trimmed with white. We went up the rock path to the door, where Ansa halted everyone except us and made them remain outside. We entered, a bare room smelling of stale tobacco. There was a sheet-iron stove in the center of a wooden frame filled with sand, and a faded map on the wall and the dingy plat of a township. Behind a scarred, littered table, a man with a fierce roach of iron-gray hair peered at us over steel spectacles.
"Got him, did you, Ansa?" he said.
"Got him, squire."
He opened a huge, dusty book and drew it to him and dipped a foul pen into an inkwell filled with what looked like coal dust.
"Look here, mister," Shreve said.
"The prisoner's name," the squire said.
I told him. He wrote it slowly into the book, the pen scratching with excruciating deliberation.
"Look here, mister," Shreve said. "We know this fellow. We—"
"Order in the court," Ansa said.
"Shut up, bud," Spode said. "Let him do it his way. He's going to anyhow."
"Age?" the squire said.
I told him. He wrote that, his mouth moving as he wrote.
"Occupation?"
I told him.
"Harvard student, eh?" he said.
He looked up at me, bowing his neck a little to see over the spectacles. His eyes were clear and cold, like a goat's.
"What are you up to, coming out here kidnapping children?"
"They're crazy, squire," Shreve said. "Whoever says this boy's kidnapping—"
Julio moved violently.
"Crazy," he said. "Don't I catch him, eh? Don't I see with my own eyes?"
"You're a liar," Shreve said. "You never—"
"Order, order," Ansa said, raising his voice.
"You fellas shut up," the squire said. "If they don't stay quiet, turn them out, Ansa."
They got quiet. The squire looked at Shreve, then at Spode, then at Gerald.
"You know this young man?" he said to Spode.
"Yes, Your Honor," Spode said. "He's just a country boy in school up there. He don't mean any harm. I think the marshal'll find it's a mistake. His father's a congregational minister."
"Hmm," the squire said. "What was you doing exactly?"
I told him, he watching me with his cold, pale eyes.
"How about it, Ansa?"
"Might have been," Ansa said. "Them dern foreigners."
"I American," Julio said. "I got a the paper." Where's the gal?
He sent her home, Ansa said.
Was she scared or anything?
Not till Julio there jumped on the prisoner. They were just walking along the river path towards town. Some boys swimming told us which way they went.
It's a mistake, Squire, Spode said. Children and dogs are always taking up with him like that. He can't help it.
Hmm, the squire said. He looked out of the window for a while. We watched him. I could hear Julio scratching himself. The squire looked back.
Are you satisfied the gal ain't took any hurt you there?
No hurt now, Julio said sullenly.
You quit work to hunt for her?
Sure I quit. I run like hell. Looky here, looka there. Then man telling me he's seen him give her she eat. She go with her.
Hmm, the squire said.
Well, son, I calculate you owe Julio something for taking him away from his work.
Yes, sir, I said. How much?
$1, I calculate.
I gave Julio $1.
Well, Spode said, if that's all, I reckon he's discharged, Your Honor.
The squire didn't look at him.
How far'd you run him, Ansa?
2 miles, at least. It was about 2 hours before we caught him.
Hmm, the squire said. He mused a while. We watched him, his stiff crest, the spectacles riding low on his nose. The yellow shape of the window grew slowly across the floor, reached the wall, climbing. Dust motes whirled and slanted.
$6.
$6, Shreve said. What's that for?
$6, the squire said.
He looked at Shreve a moment, then at me again.
Look here, Shreve said.
Shut up, Spode said. Give it to him, bud, and let's get out of here. The ladies are waiting for us. You got $6?
Yes, I said.
I gave him $6.
Case dismissed, he said.
You get a receipt, Shreve said. You get a signed receipt for that money.
The squire looked at Shreve mildly.
Case dismissed, he said, without raising his voice.
I'll be damned, Shreve said.
Come on here, Spode said, taking his arm. Good afternoon, Judge. Much obliged. As we passed out the door, Julio's voice rose again, violent, then ceased. Spode was looking at me, his brown eyes quizzical, a little cold.
Well, bud, I reckon you'll do your girl chasing in Boston after this.
You damned fool, Shreve said. What the hell do you mean anyway, straggling off here, fooling with these damn wops?
Come on, Spode said. They must be getting impatient.
Mrs. Bland was talking to them. They were Miss Holmes and Miss Dangerfield, and they quit listening to her and looked at me again with that delicate and curious horror, their veils turned back upon their little white noses and their eyes fleeing and mysterious beneath the veils.
Quentin Compson, Mrs. Bland said.
What would your mother say? A young man naturally gets into scrapes, but to be arrested on foot by a country policeman.
What did they think he'd done, Gerald?
Nothing, Gerald said.
Nonsense. What was it you, Spode?
He was trying to kidnap that little dirty girl, but they caught him in time, Spode said.
Nonsense, Mrs. Bland said, but her voice sort of died away and she stared at me for a moment, and the girls drew their breaths in with a soft, concerted sound.
Fiddlesticks, Mrs. Bland said briskly.
If that isn't just like these ignorant, low-class Yankees. Get in, Quentin.
Shreve and I sat on 2 small collapsible seats. Gerald cranked the car and got in, and we started.
Now, Quentin, you tell me what all this foolishness is about, Mrs. Bland said.
I told them, Shreve hunched and furious on his little seat, and Spode sitting again on the back of his neck beside Miss Dangerfield.
And the joke is, all the time Quentin had us all fooled, Spode said. All the time we thought he was the model youth that anybody could trust a daughter with until the police showed him up at his nefarious work.
Hush up, Spode, Mrs. Bland said. We drove down the street and crossed the bridge and passed the house where the pink garment hung in the window.
That's what you get for not reading my note. Why didn't you come and get it? Mr. McKenzie says he told you it was there.
Yes, sir, I intended to, but I never went back to the room.
You'd have let us sit there waiting I don't know how long if it hadn't been for Mr. McKenzie.
When he said you hadn't come back, that left an extra place, so we asked him to come.
We're very glad to have you anyway, Mr. McKenzie.
Shreve said nothing. His arms were folded, and he glared straight ahead past Gerald's cap. It was a cap for motoring in England. Mrs. Bland said so. We passed that house and three others, and another yard where the little girl stood by the gate. She didn't have the bread now, and her face looked like it had been streaked with coal dust. I waved my hand, but she made no reply, only her head turned slowly as the car passed, following us with her unwinking gaze. Then we ran beside the wall, our shadows running along the wall, and after a while we passed a piece of torn newspaper lying beside the road, and I began to laugh again. I could feel it in my throat, and I looked off into the trees where the afternoon slanted, thinking of afternoon and of the bird and the boys in swimming. But still I couldn't stop it, and then I knew that if I tried too hard to stop it, I'd be crying, and I thought about how I'd thought about how I could not be a virgin, with so many of them walking along in the shadows and whispering with their soft girl voices, lingering in the shadowy places, and the words coming out, and perfume, and eyes you could feel not see. But if it was that simple to do, it wouldn't be anything, and if it wasn't anything, what was I? And then Mrs. Bland said, "Quentin, is he sick, Mr. Mackenzie?" And then Shreve's fat hand touched my knee, and Spode began talking, and I quit trying to stop it. "If that hamper is in his way, Mr. Mackenzie, move it over on your side. I brought a hamper of wine because I think young gentlemen should drink wine, although my father, Gerald's grandfather—" "Ever do that? Have you ever done that? In the gray darkness, a little light, her hands locked about—" "They do when they can get it," Spode said. "Hey, Shreve!" Her knees, her face looking at the sky, the smell of honeysuckle upon her face and throat. "Beer, too," Shreve said. His hand touched my knee again. I moved my knee again, like a thin wash of lilac-colored paint, talking about him bringing— "You're not a gentleman," Spode said. "Him between us until the shape of her blurred not with dark—" "No, I'm Canadian," Shreve said. Talking about him, the oar blades winking him along, winking the cap made for motoring in England, and all time rushing beneath, and they two blurred within the other forevermore, he had been in the army, had killed men. "I adore Canada," Miss Dangerfield said. "I think it's marvelous." "Did you ever drink perfume?" Spode said. With one hand he could lift her to his shoulder and run with her, running, running. "No," Shreve said. Running, the beast with two backs, and she blurred in the winking oars, running, the swine of Eubelius, running coupled within how many, Caddy?
"Neither did I," Spode said.
"I don't know too many. There was something terrible in me, terrible in me. Father, I have committed. Have you ever done that? We didn't do that, did we, do that?"
"And Gerald's grandfather always picked his own mint before breakfast while the dew was still on it. He wouldn't even let old Wilkie touch it, do you remember, Gerald, but always gathered it himself and made his own julep. He was as crotchety about his julep as an old maid, measuring everything by a recipe in his head. There was only one man he ever gave that recipe to. That was—"
"We did. How can you not know it? If you'll just wait, I'll tell you how it was. It was a crime. We did a terrible crime. It cannot be hid. You think it can, but wait. Poor Quentin, you've never done that, have you? And I'll tell you how it was. I'll tell Father. Then it'll have to be because you love Father. Then we'll have to go away amid the pointing and the horror, the clean flame. I'll make you say we did. I'm stronger than you. I'll make you know we did. You thought it was them, but it was me. Listen, I fooled you all the time. It was me. You thought I was in the house where that damn honeysuckle, trying not to think, the swing, the cedars, the secret surges, the breathing locked, drinking the wild breath, the yes, 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 yes.
Never begot to drink wine himself, but he always said that a hamper—what book did you read that in, the one where Gerald's rowing suit of wine was a necessary part of any gentleman's picnic basket?"
"Did you love them, Caddy? Did you love them? When they touched me, I died." One minute she was standing there, the next he was yelling and pulling at her dress. They went into the hall and up the stairs, yelling and shoving at her up the stairs to the bathroom door, and stopped, her back against the door, and her arm across her face, yelling and trying to shove her into the bathroom when she came into supper. T.P. was feeding him. He started again, just whimpering at first, until she touched him. Then he yelled. She stood there, her eyes like cornered rats. Then I was running in the gray darkness. It smelled of rain and all flower scents, the damp, warm air released, and crickets sawing away in the grass, pacing me with a small traveling island of silence. Fancy watched me across the fence, blotchy like a quilt on a line. I thought that damn nigger, he forgot to feed her again. I ran down the hill in that vacuum of crickets like a breath traveling across a mirror. She was lying in the water, her head on the sandspit, the water flowing about her hips. There was a little more light in the water. Her skirt, half-saturated, flopped along her flanks to the water's motion in heavy ripples, going nowhere, renewed themselves of their own movement. I stood on the bank. I could smell the honeysuckle on the water gap. The air seemed to drizzle with honeysuckle, and with the rasping of crickets, a substance you could feel on the flesh. Is Benji still crying? I don't know. Yes, I don't know. Poor Benji. I sat down on the bank. The grass was damp a little, and I found my shoes wet. Get out of that water. Are you crazy? But she didn't move. Her face was a white blur, framed out of the blur of the sand by her hair. Get out now. She sat up, then she rose, her skirt flopped against her, draining. She climbed the bank, her clothes flopping, sat down. Why don't you wring it out? Do you want to catch cold? Yes. The water sucked and gurgled across the sandspit, and on in the dark among the willows, across the shallow, the water rippled like a piece of cloth, holding still a little light as water does. He's crossed all the oceans all around the world. Then she talked about him, clasping her wet knees, her face tilted back in the gray light, the smell of honeysuckle. There was a light in Mother's room and in Benji's where T.P. was putting him to bed. Do you love him? Her hand came out. I didn't move. It fumbled down my arm, and she held my hand flat against her chest, her heart thudding. No, no. Did he make you? Then he made you do it. Let him. He was stronger than you, and he... Tomorrow I'll kill him. I swear I will. Father needn't know until afterward, and then you and I, nobody need ever know. We can take my school money. We can cancel my matriculation. Caddy, you hate him, don't you? Don't you? She held my hand against her chest, her heart thudding. I turned and caught her arm. Caddy, you hate him, don't you? She moved my hand up against her throat. Her heart was hammering there. Poor Quentin. Her face looked at the sky. It was low, so low that all smells and sounds of night seemed to have been crowded down like under a slack tent, especially the honeysuckle. It had got into my breathing. It was on her face and throat, like paint. Her blood pounded against my hand. I was leaning on my other arm. It began to jerk and jump, and I had to pant to get any air at all out of that thick gray honeysuckle. Yes, I hate him. I would die for him. I've already died for him. I die for him over and over again every time this goes. When I lifted my hand, I could still feel crisscrossed twigs and grass burning into the palm. Poor Quentin. She leaned back on her arms, her hands locked about her knees. You've never done that, have you? What, done what? That, what I have, what I did. Yes, yes, lots of times with lots of girls. Then I was crying. Her hand touched me again, and I was crying against her damp blouse. Then she, lying on her back, looking past my head into the sky, I could see a rim of white under her irises. I opened my knife. Do you remember the day Damity died when you sat down in the water in your drawers? Yes. I held the point of the knife at her throat. It won't take but a second, just a second, then I can do mine. I can do mine, then. All right. Can you do yours by yourself? Yes, the blade's long enough. Benji's in bed by now. Yes. It won't take but a second. I'll try not to hurt. All right. Will you close your eyes? No, like this you'll have to push it harder. Touch your hand to it. But she didn't move. Her eyes were wide open, looking past my head at the sky. Caddy, do you remember how Dilsey fussed at you because your drawers were muddy? Don't cry. I'm not crying, Caddy. Push it. Are you going to? Do you want me to? Yes, push it. Touch your hand to it. Don't cry, poor Quentin. But I couldn't stop. She held my head against her damp, hard breast. I could hear her heart going firm and slow now, not hammering, and the water gurgling among the willows in the dark, and waves of honeysuckle coming up the air. My arm and shoulder were twisted under me. What is it? What are you doing? Her muscles gathered. I sat up. It's my knife. I dropped it. She sat up. What time is it? I don't know. She rose to her feet. I fumbled along the ground. I'm going. Let it go. To the house. I could feel her standing there. I could smell her damp clothes, feeling her there. It's right here somewhere. Let it go. You can find it tomorrow. Come on. Wait a minute. I'll find it. Are you afraid, too?
Here it is. It was right here all the time.
Was it? Come on. I got up and followed. We went up the hill, the crickets hushing before us. It's funny how you can sit down and drop something and have to hunt all around for it.
The gray, it was gray with dew slanting up into the gray sky, then the trees beyond.
Damn that honeysuckle, I wish it would stop.
You used to like it.
We crossed the crest and went on toward the trees. She walked into me, she gave over a little, the ditch was a black scar on the gray grass. She walked into me again, she looked at me and gave over, we reached the ditch.
Let's go this way.
What for?
Let's see if you can still see Nancy's bones. I haven't thought to look in a long time, have you?
It was matted with vines and briars, dark.
They were right here. You can't tell whether you see them or not, can you?
Stop, Quentin.
Come on.
The ditch narrowed, closed. She turned toward the trees.
Stop, Quentin.
Caddy.
I got in front of her again.
Caddy.
Stop it.
I held her.
I'm stronger than you.
She was motionless, hard, unyielding, but still.
I won't fight. Stop. You'd better stop.
Caddy, don't, Caddy.
It won't do any good, don't you know? It won't let me go.
The honeysuckle drizzled and drizzled. I could hear the crickets watching us in a circle. She moved back, went around me on toward the trees.
You go on back to the house. You needn't come.
I went on.
Why don't you go on back to the house?
Damn that honeysuckle. We reached the fence. She crawled through. I crawled through. When I rose from stooping, he was coming out of the trees into the gray, toward us, coming toward us tall and flat and still, even moving like he was still. She went to him.
This is Quentin. I'm wet. I'm wet all over. You don't have to if you don't want to.
Their shadows, one shadow, her head rose. It was above his on the sky, higher, their two heads.
You don't have to if you don't want to.
Then not two heads, the darkness smelled of rain, of damp grass and leaves, the gray light drizzling like rain, the honeysuckle coming up in damp waves. I could see her face, a blur against his shoulder. He held her in one arm like she was no bigger than a child. He extended his hand.
Glad to know you.
We shook hands then. We stood there, her shadow high against his shadow, one shadow.
What are you going to do, Quentin?
Walk a while. I think I'll go through the woods to the road and come back through town.
I turned away, going.
Good night.
Quentin?
I stopped.
What do you want?
In the woods the tree frogs were going, smelling rain in the air. They sounded like toy music boxes that were hard to turn, and the honeysuckle.
Come here.
What do you want?
Come here, Quentin.
I went back. She touched my shoulder, leaning down, her shadow, the blur of her face, leaning down from his high shadow. I drew back.
Look out.
You go on home.
I'm not sleepy. I'm going to take a walk.
Wait for me at the branch.
I'm going for a walk.
I'll be there soon. Wait for me. You wait.
No, I'm going through the woods.
I didn't look back. The tree frogs didn't pay me any mind. The gray light like moss in the trees, drizzling, but still it wouldn't rain. After a while I turned, went back to the edge of the woods. As soon as I got there I began to smell honeysuckle again. I could see the lights on the courthouse clock and the glare of town, the square on the sky, and the dark willows along the branch, and the light in Mother's windows, the light still on in Benji's room. And I stooped through the fence and went across the pasture running. I ran in the gray grass among the crickets, the honeysuckle getting stronger and stronger, and the smell of water. Then I could see the water, the color of gray honeysuckle. I lay down on the bank with my face close to the ground so I couldn't smell the honeysuckle. I couldn't smell it then, and I lay there feeling the earth going through my clothes, listening to the water. And after a while I wasn't breathing so hard, and I lay there thinking that if I didn't move my face I wouldn't have to breathe hard and smell it. And then I wasn't thinking about anything at all. She came along the bank and stopped. I didn't move.
It's late. You go on home.
What?
You go on home. It's late.
All right. Her clothes rustled. I didn't move. They stopped rustling.
Are you going in like I told you?
I didn't hear anything.
Caddy.
Yes, I will if you want me to. I will. I sat up. She was sitting on the ground, her hands clasped about her knee.
Go on to the house like I told you.
Yes, I'll do anything you want me to. Anything, yes.
She didn't even look at me. I caught her shoulder and shook her hard. You shut up.
I shook her. You shut up, you shut up!
Yes.
She lifted her face then. I saw she wasn't even looking at me at all. I could see that white rim. Get up. I pulled her. She was limp. I lifted her to her feet. Go on now.
Was Benji still crying when you left? Go on.
We crossed the branch. The roof came in sight, then the windows upstairs. He's asleep now. I had to stop and fasten the gate. She went on in the gray light, the smell of rain, and still it wouldn't rain, and honeysuckle beginning to come from the garden fence, beginning. She went into the shadow. I could hear her feet then. Caddy. I stopped at the steps. I couldn't hear her feet. Caddy. I heard her feet, then my hand touched her, not warm, not cool, just still, her clothes a little damp still. Do you love him now? Not breathing, except slow, like far away breathing. Caddy, do you love him now?
I don't know.
Outside the gray light, the shadows of things like dead things in stagnant water. I wish you were dead.
Do you? You coming in now?
Are you thinking about him now?
I don't know.
Tell me what you're thinking about. Tell me.
Stop, stop, Quentin.
You shut up, you shut up. You hear me? You shut up. Are you going to shut up?
All right, I will. Stop. We'll make too much noise.
I'll kill you, do you hear?
Let's go out to the swing. They'll hear you here.
I'm not crying. Do you say I'm crying?
No, hush now. We'll wake Benji up.
You go on into the house. Go on now.
I am. Don't cry. I'm bad anyway. You can't help it.
There's a curse on us. It's not our fault. Is it our fault?
Hush, come on and go to bed now.
You can't make me. There's a curse on us. Finally, I saw him. He was just going into the barber shop. He looked out. I went on and waited. I've been looking for you 2 or 3 days. You wanted to see me?
I'm going to see you.
He rolled the cigarette quickly with about 2 motions. He struck the match with his thumb. We can't talk here. Suppose I meet you somewhere.
I'll come to your room. Are you at the hotel?
No, that's not so good. You know that bridge over the creek in there back of...
Yes, all right.
At 1 o'clock, right?
Yes.
I turned away.
I'm obliged to you.
Look. I stopped, looked back. She all right? He looked like he was made out of bronze, his khaki shirt. She need me for anything now?
I'll be there at 1.
She heard me tell TP to saddle Prince at 1 o'clock. She kept watching me, not eating much. She came too.
What are you going to do?
Nothing. Can't I go for a ride if I want to?
You're going to do something. What is it?
None of your business, whore. Whore! TP had Prince at the side door. I won't want him. I'm going to walk. I went down the drive and out the gate. I turned into the lane. Then I ran before I reached the bridge. I saw him leaning on the rail. The horse was hitched in the woods. He looked over his shoulder. Then he turned his back. He didn't look up until I came onto the bridge and stopped. He had a piece of bark in his hands, breaking pieces from it and dropping them over the rail into the water. I came to tell you to leave town. He broke a piece of bark deliberately, dropped it carefully into the water, watched it float away. I said, you must leave town. He looked at me.
Did she send you to me?
I say you must go. Not my father, not anybody. I say it.
Listen, save this for a while. I want to know if she's all right. Have they been bothering her up there?
That's something you don't need to trouble yourself about.
Then I heard myself saying, I'll give you until sundown to leave town.
He broke a piece of bark and dropped it into the water. Then he laid the bark on the rail and rolled the cigarette with those 2 swift motions, spun the match over the rail.
What will you do if I don't leave?
I'll kill you. Don't think that just because I look like a kid to you. The smoke flowed in 2 jets from his nostrils across his face.
How old are you?
I began to shake. My hands were on the rail. I thought if I hid them, he'd know why.
I'll give you until tonight.
Listen, buddy, what's your name? Benji's the natural, isn't he? You are...
Quentin.
My mouth said it. I didn't say it at all.
I'll give you till sundown.
Quentin. He raked the cigarette ash carefully off against the rail. He did it slowly and carefully, like sharpening a pencil. My hands had quit shaking.
Listen, no good taking it so hard. It's not your fault, kid. It would have been some other fellow.
Did you ever have a sister? Did you? No, but they're all bitches.
I hit him. My open hand beat the impulse to shut it to his face. His hand moved as fast as mine. The cigarette went over the rail. I swung with the other hand. He caught it, too, before the cigarette reached the water. He held both my wrists in the same hand. His other hand flicked to his armpit under his coat. Behind him the sun slanted, and a bird singing somewhere beyond the sun. We looked at one another while the bird singing. He turned my hands loose.
"Look here."
He took the bark from the rail and dropped it into the water. It bobbed up. The current took it, floated away. His hand lay on the rail holding the pistol loosely. We waited.
"You can't hit it now."
"No."
It floated on. It was quite still in the woods. I heard the bird again, and the water afterward. The pistol came up. He didn't aim at all. The bark disappeared. Then pieces of it floated up, spreading.
He hit two more of them, pieces of bark no bigger than silver dollars.
"That's enough, I guess."
He swung the cylinder out and blew into the barrel. A thin wisp of smoke dissolved. He reloaded the three chambers, shut the cylinder. He handed it to me butt first.
"What for? I won't try to beat that."
"You'll need it from what you said. I'm giving you this one because you've seen what it'll do."
"To hell with your gun."
I hit him. I was still trying to hit him long after he was holding my wrists, but I still tried. Then it was like I was looking at him through a piece of colored glass. I could hear my blood, and then I could see the sky again and branches against it, and the sun slanting through them, and he holding me on my feet.
"Did you hit me?"
"I couldn't hear."
"What?"
"Yes. How do you feel?"
"All right, let go."
He let me go. I leaned against the rail.
"Do you feel all right?"
"Let me alone. I'm all right."
"Can you make it home all right?"
"Go on. Let me alone."
"You'd better not try to walk. Take my horse."
"No, you go on."
"You can hang the reins on the pummel and turn him loose. He'll go back to the stable."
"Let me alone. You go on and let me alone."
I leaned on the rail, looking at the water. I heard him untie the horse and ride off, and after a while I couldn't hear anything but the water, and then the bird again. I left the bridge and sat down with my back against a tree and leaned my head against the tree and shut my eyes. A patch of sun came through and fell across my eyes, and I moved a little further around the tree. I heard the bird again and the water, and then everything sort of rolled away, and I didn't feel anything at all. I felt almost good after all those days and the nights with honeysuckle coming up out of the darkness into my room where I was trying to sleep, even when after a while I knew that he hadn't hit me, that he had lied about that for her sake, too, and that I had just passed out like a girl. But even that didn't matter anymore, and I sat there against the tree with little flecks of sunlight brushing across my face like yellow leaves on a twig, listening to the water and not thinking about anything at all. Even when I heard the horse coming fast, I sat there with my eyes closed and heard its feet bunch, scuttering the hissing sand, and feet running, and her hard running hands. "Fool, fool, are you hurt?" I opened my eyes, her hands running on my face.
"I didn't know which way until I heard the pistol. I didn't know where. I didn't think he and you running off, slipping. I didn't think he would have—"
She held my face between her hands, bumping my head against the tree.
"Stop, stop that."
I caught her wrists.
"Quit that, quit it." "I knew he wouldn't, I knew he wouldn't."
She tried to bump my head against the tree.
"I told him never to speak to me again, I told him—"
She tried to break her wrists free.
"Let me go."
"Stop it, I'm stronger than you, stop it now."
"Let me go, I've got to catch him and ask his—" "Let me go, Quentin, please, let me go, let me go."
All at once she quit, her wrists went lax.
"Yes, I can tell him. I can make him believe any time. I can make him—"
"Caddy." She hadn't hitched Prince. He was liable to strike out for home if the notion took him.
"Any time he will believe me."
"Do you love him, Caddy?"
"Do I what?"
She looked at me then, everything emptied out of her eyes, and they looked like the eyes in statues, blank and unseeing and serene.
"Put your hand against my throat."
She took my hand and held it flat against her throat.
"Now say his name."
"Dalton Ames." I felt the first surge of blood there. It surged in strong, accelerating beats.
"Say it again."
Her face looked off into the trees where the sun slanted and where the bird—
"Say it again."
"Dalton Ames." Her blood surged steadily, beating and beating against my hand.
It kept on running for a long time, but my face felt cold and sort of dead, and my eye and the cut place on my finger was smarting again. I could hear Shreve working the pump. Then he came back with the basin and a round blob of twilight wobbling in it, with a yellow edge like a fading balloon, then my reflection. I tried to see my face in it. "Has it stopped?" Shreve said. "Give me the rag." He tried to take it from my hand. "Look out," I said. "I can do it. Yes, it's about stopped now." I dipped the rag again, breaking the balloon. The rag stained the water. "I wish I had a clean one." "You need a piece of beefsteak for that eye," Shreve said. "Damn if you won't have a shiner tomorrow, the son of a bitch," he said. "Did I hurt him any?" I wrung out the handkerchief and tried to clean the blood off of my vest. "You can't get that off," Shreve said. "You'll have to send it to the cleaners. Come on, hold it on your eye, why don't you?" "I can get some of it off," I said, but I wasn't doing much good. "What sort of shape is my collar in?" "I don't know," Shreve said. "Hold it against your eye, here." "Look out," I said. "I can do it. Did I hurt him any?" "You may have hit him. I may have looked away just then, or blinked or something. He boxed the hell out of you. He boxed you all over the place. What do you want to fight him with your fists for, you goddamn fool? How do you feel?" "I feel fine," I said. "I wonder if I can get something to clean my vest." "Oh, forget your damn clothes. Does your eye hurt?" "I feel fine," I said. Everything was sort of violet and still, the sky green, paling into gold beyond the gable of the house, and a plume of smoke rising from the chimney without any wind. I heard the pump again. A man was filling a pail, watching us across his pumping shoulder. A woman crossed the door, but she didn't look out. I could hear a cow lowing somewhere. "Come on," Shreve said. "Let your clothes alone and put that rag on your eye. I'll send your suit out first thing tomorrow." "All right. I'm sorry I didn't bleed on him a little, at least." "Son of a bitch," Shreve said. Spode came out of the house, talking to the woman, I reckon, and crossed the yard. He looked at me with his cold, quizzical eyes. "Well, bud," he said, looking at me, "I'll be damned if you don't go to a lot of trouble to have your fun. Kidnapping, then fighting. What do you do on your holidays, burn houses?" "I'm all right," I said. "What did Mrs. Bland say?" "She's giving Gerald hell for bloodying you up. She'll give you hell for letting him when she sees you. She don't object to the fighting, it's the blood that annoys her. I think you lost caste with her a little by not holding your blood better. How do you feel?" "Sure," Shreve said. "If you can't be a Bland, the next best thing is to commit adultery with one or get drunk and fight him, as the case may be." "Quite right," Spode said. "But I didn't know Quentin was drunk." "He wasn't," Shreve said. "Do you have to be drunk to want to hit that son of a bitch?" "Well, I think I'd have to be pretty drunk to try it, after seeing how Quentin came out. Where'd he learn to box?" "He's been going to Max every day over in town," I said. "He has," Spode said. "Did you know that when you hit him?" "I don't know," I said. "I guess so, yes." "Wet it again," Shreve said. "Want some fresh water?" "This is all right," I said. I dipped the cloth again and held it to my eye. "Wish I had something to clean my vest." Spode was watching me. "Say," he said, "what did you hit him for? What was it he said?" "I don't know. I don't know why I did. The first I knew was when you jumped up all of a sudden and said, 'Did you ever have a sister, did you?' And when he said no, you hit him. I noticed he kept on looking at him, but you didn't seem to be paying any attention to what anybody was saying until you jumped up and asked him if he had any sisters." "Ah, he was blowing off as usual," Shreve said, "about his women. You know, like he does, before girls, so they don't know exactly what he's saying. All his damn innuendo and lying and a lot of stuff that don't make sense even. Telling us about some wench that he made a date with to meet at a dance hall in Atlantic City, and stood her up and went to the hotel and went to bed, and how he lay there being sorry for her, waiting on the pier for him, without him there to give her what she wanted. Talking about the body's beauty and the sorry ends thereof and how tough women have it, without anything else they can do except lie on their backs. Lita lurking in the bushes, whimpering and moaning for the swan, see? The son of a bitch. I'd hit him myself. Only I'd grabbed up her damn hamper of wine and done it if it had been me." "Oh," Spode said, "the champion of dames. Bud, you excite not only admiration but horror." He looked at me, cold and quizzical. "Good God," he said. "I'm sorry I hit him," I said. "Do I look too bad to go back and get it over with?" "Apologies, hell," Shreve said. "Let them go to hell. We're going to town."
He ought to go back so they'll know he fights like a gentleman, Spode said. Gets licked like one, I mean.
Like this, Shreve said, with his clothes all over blood?
Why, all right, Spode said. You know best.
He can't go around in his undershirt, Shreve said. He's not a senior yet. Come on, let's go to town.
You needn't come, I said. You go on back to the picnic.
Hell with them, Shreve said. Come on here.
What'll I tell them, Spode said. Tell them you and Quentin had a fight, too?
Tell them nothing, Shreve said. Tell her her option expired at sunset. Come on, Quentin. I'll ask that woman where the nearest interurban...
No, I said. I'm not going back to town.
Shreve stopped, looking at me. Turning, his glasses looked like small yellow moons.
What are you going to do?
I'm not going back to town yet.
You go on back to the picnic. Tell them I wouldn't come back because my clothes were spoiled.
Look here, he said. What are you up to?
Nothing, I'm all right. You and Spode go on back. I'll see you tomorrow.
I went on across the yard toward the road.
Do you know where the station is? Shreve said. I'll find it. I'll see you all tomorrow. Tell Mrs. Bland I'm sorry I spoiled her party.
They stood watching me. I went around the house. A rock path went down to the road. Roses grew on both sides of the path. I went through the gate onto the road. It dropped downhill toward the woods, and I could make out the auto beside the road. I went up the hill. The light increased as I mounted, and before I reached the top I heard a car. It sounded far away across the twilight, and I stopped and listened to it. I couldn't make out the auto any longer, but Shreve was standing in the road before the house, looking up the hill. Behind him the yellow light lay like a wash of paint on the roof of the house. I lifted my hand and went on over the hill, listening to the car. Then the house was gone, and I stopped in the green and yellow light and heard the car growing louder and louder, until just as it began to die away, it ceased altogether. I waited until I heard it start again. Then I went on. As I descended, the light dwindled slowly, yet at the same time, without altering its quality, as if I, and not light, were changing, decreasing, though even when the road ran into trees you could have read a newspaper. Pretty soon I came to a lane. I turned into it. It was closer and darker than the road, but when it came out at the trolley stop, another wooden marquee, the light was still unchanged. After the lane it seemed brighter, as though I had walked through night in the lane and come out into morning again. Pretty soon the car came. I got on it, they turning to look at my eye, and found a seat on the left side. The lights were on in the car, so while we ran between trees I couldn't see anything except my own face and a woman across the aisle with a hat sitting right on top of her head, with a broken feather in it. But when we ran out of the trees I could see the twilight again, that quality of light as if time really had stopped for a while, with the sun hanging just under the horizon. And then we passed the marquee where the old man had been eating out of the sack, and the road going on under the twilight, into twilight, and the sense of water peaceful and swift beyond. Then the car went on, the draft building steadily up in the open door until it was drawing steadily through the car with the odor of summer and darkness, except honeysuckle. Honeysuckle was the saddest odor of all, I think. I remember lots of them. Wisteria was one. On the rainy days when Mother wasn't feeling quite bad enough to stay away from the windows, we used to play under it. When Mother stayed in bed, Dilsey would put old clothes on us and let us go out in the rain because she said rain never hurt young folks. But if Mother was up, we always began by playing on the porch until she said we were making too much noise. Then we went out and played under the wisteria frame. This was where I saw the river for the last time this morning, about here. I could feel water beyond the twilight, smell. When it bloomed in the spring and it rained, the smell was everywhere. You didn't notice it so much at other times, but when it rained, the smell began to come into the house at twilight. Either it would rain more at twilight, or there was something in the light itself, but it always smelled strongest then, until I would lie in bed thinking, when will it stop, when will it stop? The draft in the door smelled of water, a damp, steady breath. Sometimes I could put myself to sleep saying that over and over, until after the honeysuckle got all mixed up in it, the whole thing came to symbolize night and unrest. I seemed to be lying neither asleep nor awake, looking down a long corridor of gray half-light where all stable things had become shadowy paradoxical, all I had done shadows, all I had felt, suffered, taking visible form, antic and perverse, mocking without relevance, inherent themselves with the denial of the significance they should have affirmed, thinking I was not. Who was not who? I could smell the curves of the river beyond the dusk, and I saw the last light supine and tranquil upon tide flats, like pieces of broken mirror. Then beyond them, lights began in the pale clear air, trembling a little like butterflies hovering a long way off. Benjamin, the child of. How he used to sit before that mirror. Refuge unfailing, in which conflict tempered, silenced, reconciled. Benjamin, the child of mine old age, held hostage into Egypt. O Benjamin. Dilsey said it was because mother was too proud for him. They come into white people's lives like that in sudden sharp black trickles that isolate white facts for an instant in unarguable truth like under a microscope. The rest of the time just voices that laugh when you see nothing to laugh at, tears when no reason for tears. They will bet on the odd or even number of mourners at a funeral. A brothel full of them in Memphis went into a religious trance, ran naked into the street. It took three policemen to subdue one of them. Yes, Jesus, oh, good man, Jesus, oh, that good man. The car stopped. I got out with them looking at my eye. When the trolley came, it was full. I stopped on the back platform. Seats up front, the conductor said. I looked into the car. There were no seats on the left side. I'm not going far, I said. I'll just stand here. We crossed the river, the bridge, that is, arching slow and high into space, between silence and nothingness where lights, yellow and red and green, trembled in the clear air, repeating themselves. Better go up front and get a seat, the conductor said. I get off pretty soon, I said, a couple of blocks. I got off before we reached the post office. They'd all be sitting around somewhere by now, though, and then I was hearing my watch, and I began to listen for the chimes, and I touched Shreve's letter through my coat, the bitten shadows of the elms flowing upon my hand. And then, as I turned into the quad, the chimes did begin, and I went on while the notes came up like ripples on a pool, and passed me, and went on, saying, quarter to what? All right, quarter to what? Our windows were dark. The entrance was empty. I walked close to the left wall when I entered, but it was empty, just the stairs curving up into shadows, echoes of feet in the sad generations like light dust upon the shadows, my feet waking them like dust, lightly to settle again. I could see the letter before I turned the light on, propped against a book on the table so I would see it, calling him my husband. And then Spode said they were going somewhere, would not be back until late, and Mrs. Bland would need another cavalier. But I would have seen him, and he cannot get another car for an hour because after 6 o'clock. I took out my watch and listened to it clicking away, not knowing it couldn't even lie. Then I laid it face up on the table, and took Mrs. Bland's letter and tore it across, and dropped the pieces into the wastebasket, and took off my coat, vest, collar, tie, and shirt. The tie was spoiled, too, but then niggers. Maybe a pattern of blood, he could call that the one Christ was wearing. I found the gasoline in Shreve's room and spread the vest on the table, where it would be flat, and opened the gasoline. The first car in town, a girl, girl. That's what Jason couldn't bear, smell of gasoline making him sick, then got madder than ever because a girl, girl. Had no sister but Benjamin, Benjamin, the child of my sorrowful, if I just had a mother so I could say mother, mother. It took a lot of gasoline, and then I couldn't tell if it was still the stain or just the gasoline. It had started the cut to smarting again, so when I went to wash, I hung the vest on a chair and lowered the light cord so that the bulb would be drying the splotch. I washed my face and hands, but even then I could smell it within the soap stinging, constricting the nostrils a little. Then I opened the bag and took the shirt and collar and tie out, and put the bloody ones in and closed the bag, and dressed. While I was brushing my hair, the half hour went. But there was until the 3/4 anyway, except suppose, seeing on the rushing darkness only his own face, no broken feather, unless 2 of them, but not 2 like that, going to Boston the same night, then my face, his face, for an instant across the crashing, when out of darkness two lighted windows in rigid fleeing crash gone, his face and mine, just I see, saw, did I see, not goodbye, the marquee empty of eating, the road empty in darkness, in silence, the bridge arching into silence, darkness, sleep, the water, peaceful and swift, not goodbye. I turned out the light and went into my bedroom, out of the gasoline, but I could still smell it. I stood at the window, the curtains moved slow out of the darkness, touching my face like someone breathing asleep, breathing slow into the darkness again, leaving the touch. After they had gone upstairs, Mother lay back in her chair, the camphor handkerchief to her mouth. Father hadn't moved. He still sat beside her, holding her hand, the bellowing hammering away like no place for it in silence. When I was little, there was a picture in one of our books, a dark place into which a single weak ray of light came slanting upon two faces lifted out of the shadow. "You know what I'd do if I were king?" She never was a queen or a fairy. She was always a king or a giant or a general. "I'd break that place open and drag them out, and I'd whip them good." It was torn out, jagged out. I was glad. I'd have to turn back to it until the dungeon was Mother herself. She and Father upward into weak light, holding hands, and us lost somewhere below, even them without even a ray of light. Then the honeysuckle got into it. As soon as I turned off the light and tried to go to sleep, it would begin to come into the room in waves, building and building up until I would have to pant to get any air at all out of it, until I would have to get up and feel my way like when I was a little boy. Hands can see, touching in the mind, shaping unseen door. Door, now nothing, hands can see. My nose could see gasoline, the vest on the table, the door. The corridor was still empty of all the feet in sad generations seeking water. Yet the eyes unseeing, clenched like teeth, not disbelieving, doubting even the absence of pain, shin, ankle, knee, the long invisible flowing of the stair railing where a misstep in the darkness, filled with sleeping, Mother, Father, Caddy, Jason, Maury, door, I am not afraid, only Mother, Father, Caddy, Jason, Maury, getting so far ahead sleeping I will sleep fast when I... Door, door, door. It was empty too, the pipes, the porcelain, the stained quiet walls, the throne of contemplation. I had forgotten the glass, but I could... Hands can see, cooling fingers, invisible swan throat, where less than Moses' rod the glass, touch, tentative, not to drumming, lean, cool throat, drumming, cooling, the metal, the glass, full, overfull, cooling the glass, the fingers flushing sleep, leaving the taste of dampened sleep in the long silence of the throat. I returned up the corridor, waking the lost feet and whispering battalions in the silence, into the gasoline, the watch telling its furious lie on the dark table. Then the curtains breathing out of the dark upon my face, leaving the breathing upon my face. A quarter hour yet, and then I'll not be. The peacefulest words. Non fui, sum fui, non sum. Somewhere I heard bells once, Mississippi or Massachusetts. I was, I am not. Massachusetts or Mississippi. Shreve has a bottle in his trunk. Aren't you even going to open it? Mr. and Mrs. Jason Richmond Compson announced the... Three times. Days. Aren't you even going to open it? Marriage of their daughter Candace. That liquor teaches you to confuse the means with the end. I am. Drink. I was not. Let us sell Benji's pasture so that Quentin may go to Harvard and I may knock my bones together and together. I will be dead in... Was it 1 year, Caddy said? Shreve has a bottle in his trunk. Sir, I will not need Shreve's. I have sold Benji's pasture and I can be dead in Harvard, Caddy said, in the caverns and the grottos of the sea, tumbling peacefully to the wavering tides. Because Harvard is such a fine sound, 40 acres is no high price for a fine sound. A fine dead sound. We will swap Benji's pasture for a fine dead sound. It will last him a long time because he cannot hear it unless he can smell it. As soon as she came in the door, he began to cry. I thought all the time it was just one of those town squirts that Father was always teasing her about until... I didn't notice him any more than any other stranger drummer, or what thought They were army shirts, until all of a sudden I knew he wasn't thinking of me at all as a potential source of harm, but was thinking of her when he looked at me, was looking at me through her, like through a piece of colored glass. "Why must you meddle with me? Don't you know it won't do any good? I thought you'd have left that for Mother and Jason. Did Mother set Jason to spy on you?" "I wouldn't have. Women only use other people's codes of honor. It's because she loves Caddy." Staying downstairs even when she was sick, so Father couldn't kid Uncle Maury before Jason. Father said Uncle Maury was too poor a classicist to risk the blind, immortal boy in person. He should have chosen Jason, because Jason would have made only the same kind of blunder Uncle Maury himself would have made, not one to get him a black eye. The Patterson boy was smaller than Jason, too. They sold the kites for a nickel apiece until the trouble over finances. Jason got a new partner, still smaller, one small enough, anyway. Because Teepee said Jason's still treasurer, but Father said, why should Uncle Maury work if he, Father, could support 5 or 6 niggers that did nothing at all but sit with their feet in the oven? He certainly could board and lodge Uncle Maury now and then and lend him a little money, who kept his, Father's, belief in the celestial derivation of his own species at such a fine heat. Then Mother would cry and say that Father believed his people were better than hers, that he was ridiculing Uncle Maury to teach us the same thing. She couldn't see that Father was teaching us that all men are just accumulations, dolls, stuffed with sawdust, swept up from the trash heaps where all previous dolls had been thrown away. The sawdust flowing from what wound in what side, that not for me died not. It used to be I thought of death as a man something like Grandfather, a friend of his, a kind of private and particular friend, like we used to think of Grandfather's desk, not to touch it, not even to talk loud in the room where it was. I always thought of them as being together somewhere all the time, waiting for old Colonel Sartoris to come down and sit with them, waiting on a high place beyond cedar trees. Colonel Sartoris was on a still higher place, looking out across at something, and they were waiting for him to get done looking at it and come down. Grandfather wore his uniform, and we could hear the murmur of their voices from beyond the cedars. They were always talking, and Grandfather was always right. The three quarters began. The first note sounded, measured and tranquil, serenely peremptory, emptying the unhurried silence for the next one, and that's it. If people could only change one another forever that way, merge like a flame, swirling up for an instant, then blown cleanly out along the cool eternal dark, instead of lying there trying not to think of the swing until all cedars came to have that vivid dead smell of perfume that Benji hated so. Just by imagining the clump, it seemed to me that I could hear whispers, secret surges, smell the beating of hot blood under wild, unsecret flesh, watching against red eyelids the swine, untethered in pairs, rushing coupled into the sea. And he, we must just stay awake and see evil done for a little while, it's not always, and I, it doesn't have to be even that long for a man of courage. And he, do you consider that courage? And I, yes, sir, don't you? And he, every man is the arbiter of his own virtues, whether or not you consider it courageous, is of more importance than the act itself, than any act, otherwise you could not be in earnest. And I, you don't believe I am serious. And he, I think you are too serious to give me any cause for alarm. You wouldn't have felt driven to the expedient of telling me you had committed incest, otherwise. And I wasn't lying, I wasn't lying. And he, you wanted to sublimate a piece of natural human folly into a horror and then exorcise it with truth. And I, it was to isolate her out of the loud world so that it would have to flee us of necessity, and then the sound of it would be as though it had never been. And he, did you try to make her do it? And I was afraid to, I was afraid she might, and then it wouldn't have done any good, but if I could tell you we did, it would have been so. And then the others wouldn't be so, and then the world would roar away. And he, and now this other, you are not lying now either, but you are still blind to what it is in yourself, to that part of general truth, the sequence of natural events and their causes, which shadows every man's brow, even Benji's. You are not thinking of finitude.